Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ken Rudin.
And sitting in for that other guy, Ron Elving, I'm Mara Liasson.
Mara, as you know, Ron Elving has not been the same since the death of Annette Funicello. But not only is this the first podcast in the post-Annette Funicello era, it is the last podcast at 635 Massachusetts Avenue, where NPR has been since 1994.
And it's a very sad day that we're leaving this building, but we're going to a beautiful new building.
We are, because everything will be better in the new building, as they used to tell us in the old building. But things do get better and things do change. And if anything is changing, it's what's going on in the world today. I just was thinking of this before the podcast, and allow me this little thing here. There was a movie about 10 years ago called Goodbye, Lenin, about this woman who falls into a coma. And then right after that, Germany gets reunited, Soviet Union falls, and she wakes up about 8 months later, but because her son doesn't want her to go through the shock of all the things that have changed, he makes sure that East Germany is still what it was. In other words, if somebody went into a coma about a year and a half ago and just woke up today and learned about what's going on with immigration, with guns, with marriage equality,
it would be an incredible shock. Gridlock appears, at least for the moment, to be evaporating. It is really extraordinary.
See, it's not even just gridlock that may be going away. These are heretofore intractable issues that people were just not giving in on, about guns, about same-sex marriage. Think of the Democrats who ran for president in 2008. The thought of what marriage was, it was defined by a man and a woman. And now running for a president as a Democrat in 2016, you absolutely cannot have that position. That position is long gone.
And there are so many Republicans who are even coming out for marriage equality. Now, it doesn't mean that everything is going to be easy and a slam dunk on these other issues, but immigration, certainly there's been a sea change on the politics. On guns, we saw something extraordinary this week. A Republican and a Democrat, both conservative, pro-gun voting records, come together for a background check compromise. You have the president putting forward his budget. You know, it looks like maybe the tectonic plates in Washington, which have been frozen for so long, are starting to shift.
Well, let's start with guns, because that's the big news of the week. And of course, as we're doing this podcast right now, the Senate is presumably voting to have the 60 votes to allow the debate on the gun change to go on. Tell us a little bit about the Pat Toomey and the Joe Manchin compromise.
Well, Pat Toomey is a conservative Republican from Pennsylvania. Joe Manchin, conservative Democrat from West Virginia. They got together.
Both very pro-gun.
Very good NRA voting right. records. As a matter of fact, Joe Manchin's claim to fame was when he ran for Senate. He had a campaign ad where he took a gun and shot up President Obama's climate change bill.
I'm Joe Manchin. I approve this ad because I'll always defend West Virginia.
I sued EPA, and I'll take dead aim at the cap and trade bill.
And here's Senator Manchin speaking Wednesday about the gun control proposal that he and Senator Toomey came up with.
I think I have support from who would be the most critical gun advocates as anybody in the country. They understand this is common sense. This is gun sense. We're not infringing on their rights as an individual citizen. But basically, if you're going to go to a gun show, you should be subjected the same as if you went to the gun store. If you're going to go online, you should be the same as if you bought the gun across line, state lines, the same as if you were in state, intrastate versus interstate. All we're saying, this makes sense.
Background checks is the part of the gun control package that has the most possibility of passing. The other issues are not expected to pass, a ban on assault weapons, a ban on big ammunition clips. But they came together and they said, we're going to close these loopholes in the background check system, and we're going to do it in a way that gun owners can feel comfortable with, that nobody's guns are going to be taken away. And
there had always been background checks on those
official sales in a store,
right.
but not at gun shows.
Now we're talking about gun shows and online
sales.
Yes,
and online sales. And there was going to be a filibuster against the entire gun bill, but that filibuster seems to be evaporating. And what President Obama asked for all along, many people thought he was selling himself too short, was just, we want a vote. He didn't demand that all of his bills pass, but he said, we want a vote. And it looks like he's going to get a vote, that meaning an up or down vote, not a filibuster.
And while you think of Pennsylvania as a pro-gun state, and it really is kind of, you also wonder what this might mean for Toomey's re-election prospects in 2016.
He's up in 2016. That's the key point. That means it's a presidential year. There will be a Democrat on the ballot. Democrats win Pennsylvania in presidential years.
Of course, the last time they lost it was in 88, right?
And although there are big parts of Pennsylvania that are rural and Appalachian and are very serious gun culture areas, the big concentration of votes are in the suburbs around Philadelphia. He knows he has to do well there. And I think the politics of this for Senator Toomey are very obvious.
Obviously. Now, we also talk about what the politics is for immigration. We learn what the Republicans went through in 2012 by their rhetoric and their records on immigration, allowing the 11 million undocumented people in this country the path to citizenship. What's going on with that?
The Gang of Eight, which are the four Democrats, four Republicans in the Senate, they're about to come up with their compromise deal, which would include a pathway to citizenship, but it would be contingent on a certification that the border has been secured, that the flow of illegal immigrants is, I think, down to almost nothing. I think something like 90% fixed. And there will be hearings. It sounds like we're going to get a vote before the summer. The person to watch in all of this has been Marco Rubio, who's been part of this compromise. He's a Hispanic Republican, rising star, plans to run for president in 2016.
We think.
But can't get too far out in front of his conservative base. And he's not only the key to bringing conservatives on to vote for this bill.
Or Republicans, right?
Or Republicans. But also his own personal political prospects depend on it. The latest thing he's been doing is saying, let's not rush this. But what is also interesting about what Marco Rubio's been doing is he's been selling the idea of a pathway to citizenship to some of the most, you could call them, anti-amnesty voices in the conservative party. He's been on talk radio a lot, talking to Rush Limbaugh, going on Fox, and he's been saying what we have now in this country is amnesty. In other words, we're not going to deport 11 million people. So right now they have amnesty because they're here illegally and we're not doing anything about it.
And obviously one of the things we're thinking about is what kind of margin we're going to see in the Senate as well, because the difference with Republicans on the issues of guns and immigration is that going soft on guns may not help the Republicans on votes, but it could certainly help them with immigration.
On immigration, the politics of this turned upside down after Election Day. When Mitt Romney lost the Hispanic vote 3-1, the Republican Party woke up the next day and basically sued for peace on immigration. They said, okay, we got to do something different because we can't survive as a national party if we lose the Hispanic vote like this. The National Republican Party has decided it's got to pass an immigration bill and get this off the table.
Now, how much of a clash is there between Rubio, who wants to take it slow, who wants as many votes as he can, and Pat Leahy, who's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who really would like to get this done quicker because there's a lot of pressure from pro-immigrant groups not to wait any longer?
I think what's interesting about this is one of those cases where Marco Rubio's personal political needs completely coincides with getting the bill passed. In other words, he wants to go slow for his own personal reasons, but also he's the key to getting this passed. So I think Chuck Schumer, who's been the leader of the Gang of Eight, Democratic senator from New York, understands this. He wants to make Marco happy because Rubio is going to bring more Republican votes to this thing. So I think that there will be some kind of an accommodation made for the amount of hearings and the amount of time that Rubio needs. And also he wants to go back to his conservative base and say, hey, I forced them. I didn't just jump on board a Democratic effort.
Right? No, I think everything Rubio is doing is exactly benefiting him. I was on vacation last week in Florida. I was in a swimming pool and all these little kids were yelling, Marco, Marco. So I knew that he was doing really well with his constituents in Florida.
Where's the raspberry sound that we can play at this point?
The other key issue of the week, of course, is President Obama unveiling his budget. Didn't make everybody happy.
No. Here he is in the Rose Garden Wednesday. Let's listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
If anyone thinks I'll finish the job of deficit reduction on the backs of middle-class families or through spending cuts alone that actually hurt our economy short-term, they should think again. When it comes to deficit reduction, I've already met Republicans more than halfway, so in the coming days and weeks, I hope that Republicans will come forward and demonstrate that they're really as serious about the deficits and debt as they claim to be.
You know, this almost sounds like he's defensive in the way, because a lot of folks on the left, on the progressive left, really attacked President Obama on the budget, saying, you know, you're giving in to the Republicans, you're cutting Medicare, you're cutting Social Security without any guarantees from Republican tax increases.
What the president wants to do is triangulate. The House Republicans passed their budget. The Senate Democrats passed theirs. Two extremes. Neither can get passed through both houses of Congress. The president's come up with something in the middle. He's put some entitlement reforms in there that Democrats and liberals hate. But he's also said, I'm only going to agree to this if the Republicans will agree to tax increases in the form of getting rid of loopholes.
And what's the odds of that?
The chances of that at this point look very slim. even though in the past this framework for a grand bargain where Republicans agree to revenue increases and Democrats agree to entitlement cuts, that has always been the formula for the grand bargain. Now Republicans are saying, we don't want to do that.
Well, we've already done that. We've already raised taxes on the wealthy. We acquiesced in January. Why do it again?
And Democrats say, guess what? In the debt ceiling deal and in sequester, we had a bill that was spending cuts only. So you've had two spending cuts only deals and one tax hike only deal. Why not try something with everything? But for Republicans who are going through such painful changes on so many other issues like gay marriage, like immigration, maybe even on guns to a certain smaller extent, taxes is kind of the last bedrock principle for them. And it's so important that they're willing to say, I don't care about the deficit as much as I care about not voting for a tax increase of any form. It looks very slim now. However, the president has been looking for bipartisan partners, negotiating partners in the Senate. And the White House is hopeful that even though the House is absolutely against raising taxes in any way, shape, or form, even for entitlement cuts, that there are some Republican senators, Lindsey Graham, for instance, who's already said, I'd be willing to look at this because he made this move on entitlements. They want to see, instead of just negotiating with John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, the leaders in the House and Senate on the Republican side, see if they can get some rank-and-file Republicans to work with them.
McConnell, of course, made a lot of other news this week in the fact that he said that his campaign headquarters, when they were doing strategy, of course, he's up for his sixth term in 2014, that he was bugged, or a tape recording of his conversations, mostly around Ashley Judd at that time, a prospective Democratic challenger, got into Mother Jones and was released, and it looked embarrassing to the McConnell campaign. But of course, the McConnell people said, wait a second. Since when is the left rejoicing over illegal wiretapping? Of course, that may not have been what happened.
We don't know. We know that there is a tape recording of a conversation, and it went to Mother Jones. What we don't know.
And we do know that he's asked the FBI to investigate.
This is being investigated. What we don't know is whether it was a bug, you know, an illegal recording, or, as David Corn, who's the editor of Mother Jones, has suggested, that wasn't the case. His suggestion, and of course we'll wait for the investigation to find out, is it was more of a Mitt Romney 47% type inside job where somebody inside the room
also released
it and gave
by
it to
David
them.
Corn and Mother
yes,
Jones.
Yes. So we're going to wait to see what happens to McConnell Tapegate.
I still don't know. I mean, look, a lot of the stuff may not have been the stuff you'd want to leak out, but opposition research is stuff that both sides do. They always do. Just the fact that you hear it leaked. And of course, they were talking about Ashley Judd's mental stability, that she had suicidal tendencies when she was in the sixth grade, things like that. And so the Democrats were furious that the Republicans were mocking this, where the Republicans saying, this is Nixonian. How dare you release private conversations like this?
I see the actual contents of the tape as being inconsequential. Yeah. This was not like Mitt Romney talking about the 47%,
right,
which had a real effect on
sure
the
did.
Race. But we have to wait and see, where did this tape come from? Was it, as McConnell has suggested, a left-wing, you know, hit job, illegal taping, or was it a disgruntled Tea Party sympathetic supporter of his in the room? Who knows? We'll find out eventually.
Mara, you this week, we're talking about presidential politics. You were at Howard University, the historically black college in Washington, D.C., and a very interesting Republican speaker.
Rand Paul, Kentucky Republican senator, libertarian, widely considered to be planning a run for president in 2016, came to Howard, and he tried to sell students there on his brand of libertarian conservatism, which he claimed was more in keeping with the 19th century and early 20th century Republican Party, back when African Americans actually voted for Republicans, and that somehow or other they should either ignore or forget about what happened between, 1920 and 2012.
Post-68.
Yeah, but we do have a little bit of tape of Rand Paul. Here was his message. He got a lot of credit, by the way, from the students for just showing up.
I hope that some of you will be open to the Republican message that favors choice in education, a less aggressive foreign policy, more compassion regarding nonviolent crime, and encourages opportunity in employment. And when the time is right, I hope that African Americans will again look to the party of emancipation, civil liberty, and individual freedom.
I mean, we've seen Republicans, you know, over the last several decades go before black audiences and civil rights groups and things like that and say that, you know, the Republican Party is the party of Lincoln. But the party of Lincoln was around 1861 or thereabouts. And a lot has changed since in the intervening century and a half.
A lot has changed. Rand Paul thinks he has a couple of policy proposals that will appeal to African Americans. As he just mentioned, school choice among some African American communities, that's very popular. Certainly changing the mandatory minimum sentences for certain drug crimes, very popular with African Americans. Fewer foreign wars, those are all very popular.
The old Ron Paul foreign policy, right?
This is all the libertarian agenda. The problem is that there's so much else that Rand Paul is for that the African-American community is completely against. And also there was a big disconnect between Rand Paul and his audience. At one point he said, you know, how many of you here would know that the NAACP was started by Republicans? And all the kids said, well, sure, every single one of us knows that. And at another point he talked about the first Republican black senator. I'm blanking on his name.
For Massachusetts.
And then he came up with Edwin Brooks.
Someone yelled,
his name is Edward Brooks.
Someone yelled out Edward Brooks. He said, right,
Edwin Brooks.
And don't forget his in 2010, when he was running for the Senate, he had some very interesting comments to make about the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the provisions in it. That probably not the kind of view that he wanted to espouse at a meeting at Howard.
That's right. And he insisted that he's always been for the Civil Rights Act. But our own Robert Siegel did a really interesting interview when he was running for Senate where Rand Paul said, I really like to think that if I had been alive then, I would have marched with Dr. Martin Luther King. And Robert said to him, oh, you would have marched with Dr. King but voted with Barry Goldwater against the Civil Rights Act. So those are problems for Rand Paul and the African-American community. But let's be frank. He's not looking for African-American votes. He has to compete in a Republican primary that's almost completely white. But reaching out to minority communities is a very important part of the Republican Party's effort and any Republican candidate's effort to appear more moderate, less exclusive, and that's something that appeals not just to minority voters but also to moderate white voters in the suburbs.
You're absolutely right. When you talked earlier in the podcast, you talked about how Mitt Romney got clobbered with the Latino vote in November. The seeds of his destruction with Hispanic voters came well before November. It was during the Republican debate with the rhetoric and all the kind of conversations.
Self-deportation.
Absolutely, things like that. Speaking about self-deportation, there's a rumor here that Scott Brown, the former senator from Massachusetts, might self-deport himself to New Hampshire. He said he hasn't ruled out running for the Senate against Jean Shaheen.
Maybe New Englanders don't care about carpetbagging, but it is kind of an amazing thing. He's just shopping around for a state to run in. Why not go right across the border where Massachusetts television reaches and where people there are familiar with him.
His mother lives there. He has a summer home there.
Right. Just like Mitt Romney. I don't know how New Hampshire voters would view that, but that is something that he is definitely considering.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting. Of course, if he was looking for a Senate race to run in this year, he has one in Massachusetts right
which
now.
Which he turned down.
Which he turned down. So I kind of think that he liked to say that he hasn't ruled anything out. I think the blowback would be really intense. But of course, there have been senators in the past who have, you know, served in one state and tried to run in another. Bob Smith of New Hampshire, when he lost to John Sununu after 2002, moved to Florida. He was going to run for the Senate in 2004. That went nowhere. Jim Buckley, who served for one term in the Senate from New York in the 1970s, moved to Connecticut after Abe Ribicoff retired. You well remember Abe Ribicoff. Mara and I were just talking about him the other day. And in 1980, he ran for the Senate seat there and lost to Chris Dodd. So senators have tried it. Doesn't always work. Ultimately, I don't think Scott Brown does it, but it's certainly given Jean Shaheen a great impetus to get fundraising, saying, you know, this invader from Massachusetts is
right.
coming.
There's nothing that says opportunism more than changing states to run for a Senate seat. Another race this weekend in Illinois to replace the seat being vacated by Jesse Jackson Jr.
Right. And you're talking about how Scott Brown may want to invade New Hampshire. Well, this is a race where Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his heavy big money PAC crossed the border into Illinois in the February primary to help Robin Kelly. Basically, it was an anti-NRA ad. It opposed candidates who were very soft on gun violence. It's certainly an issue that resonates in the 2nd Congressional District in Chicago, which is a south side of Chicago in the Chicago suburbs. But anyway, Robin Kelly won about 71% of the vote. She may become, you know, we talked about, remember when Carolyn McCarthy, her husband and her son were shot on the Long Island Railroad, and she used that tragedy, and I don't know if that's the right way of saying it, but that tragedy pushed her into a political life and in the House of Representatives. You wonder if Robin Kelly could be this big advocate about guns and gun control.
Well, she certainly owes a lot to Mayor Bloomberg, and he is doing something interesting. He wants to be a counterweight to the NRA, a liberal counterweight. He's going to put his deep pockets against their deep pockets. Right. And he also said he's going to do something interesting, which is start a scoring system, a kind of report card.
Which is what the NRA does now anyway.
The NRA and many other interest groups, they score every vote, and that's how they keep members of Congress in line and not straying too far from how they want them to vote.
But it's one thing for a Democrat to vote for gun legislation in Illinois' 2nd Congressional District. It's another for a Heidi Heitkamp or a Mark Begich or a Mary Landrieu or a Mark Pryor, Democrats in pretty red states. And, you know, you wonder if Michael Bloomberg's actions and activities could actually jeopardize these Democratic seats.
Well, that's always a question, and that's clearly what the scorecard is aimed at, wavering red state Democrats. And speaking of red state Democrats who've had trouble voting for gun control and other issues, long time ago in Pennsylvania, there was a congresswoman named Marjorie Margolis Mezvinsky. She happens to be the mother-in-law of Chelsea Clinton now. She wasn't then. And she voted for an assault weapons ban. She voted for a package of gun control measures that then President Clinton wanted. And the tax bill. She voted for a lot of things that back then Pennsylvania was a little bit redder than it is today. And she lost her seat. She's thinking about running again.
Alison Schwartz, who's a congresswoman from the 13th Congressional District in Pennsylvania, has announced this week that she's filing papers to run for governor in Pennsylvania, first female governor of Pennsylvania. And Marjorie Margolis Mezvinsky, say that one time fast, is talking about reclaiming her seat. And of course, her daughter-in-law, Chelsea Clinton, has talked about perhaps not ruling out running for office one day. And, you know, if Chelsea Clinton were elected president, I just looked this up, she would be the first child of an elected president on her own since George W. Bush. I looked that up. No, I know a lot about politics.
I know you spent a lot of time doing research.
Yeah. I also spent a lot of time asking the question, what is Anthony Weiner thinking?
I don't know what he's thinking, but I'll just refer people to the front page of the New York Post without describing what it says. But Anthony Weiner is thinking about running for mayor. He wants to mount a political comeback after he was forced to resign, after he texted inappropriate photos to women who were not his wife. And he's testing the waters.
You know, this, of course, is the year of political redemption. We're talking about Mark Sanford up and down, you know, for months now, the Appalachian Trail and the soulmate and all that stuff. Weiner jokes are not, you know, your forte, shall we say.
No, I leave them all to you.
No, as you should. But here's the thing about Anthony Weiner. First of all, he still has $4.3 million in the bank. Remember, he ran for mayor in 2005, did okay in the primary, didn't win it. In 2009, he was going to run again, but Bloomberg had just too much money. He said, okay, I'm going to sit it out. And then he was probably the front runner for 2013 until he resigned from Congress 2 years ago. But what's troubling about Weiner, and this is, of course, coming off this New York Times Magazine interview that he and his wife gave this week, before he resigned, he lied to everybody. I mean, it was hacked. It was a right-wing, you know, my opponents did this to me. Anthony Weiner has a lot of opposition. He makes a lot of enemies, but he's also very passionate about what he believes in. And he probably would be a good candidate, except how do you get past something like this?
I mean, it's really, the question is what and how he handled it, a career-ending episode. There are many politicians who can come back from extramarital affairs. I mean, Mark Sanford is a perfect example.
This wasn't
That's not what this is about. Right. Not only was it not an affair, it was how he handled it. That's what it was about. It was about public trust and his integrity, and we'll see how far he gets.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Mara Liasson. Ron Elving is back next week. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.